Sort of wondering, the best podcast in South Africa? I couldn't think of anything cleverer to say than that.
What would happen if you took words and planted them in an ancient mangrove and turned them into amarula fruit and then harvested them and then distilled them and then put them back out as words?
You know how there's that sort of theory that different types of music will like affect the growth of plants and animals in different ways? If you just played this podcast to amarula fruit and then drank the produce, it would be exactly the feeling of this podcast.
Yeah, yeah. It would also, I mean, if you drink amarula and listen to this podcast, then the enlightenment will take over the world again.
Brilliant, brilliant. So enough waffling. I am half of your host, Nicholas Lorimer. And of course, joined as always by the other half of your hosts,
Gabriel Krauser.
And we've got a bit of a mixed bag of things today, starting off with a story from the Far East, which, you know, I think it's very revealing about the attitude of the Chinese state just generally to the planet, to the world, to the universe. Gabriel, you came across as you linked it to me. Why don't you have the honor of describing it to the listeners before we talk about it?
Okay, so Japan has filed an official complaint through its embassy in Beijing against Beijing's government for subjecting Japanese citizens that are in China to anal swab testing for coronavirus. Now, as Reuters describes it, an anal swab test is when you insert a swab, which is like a Q-tip, 3 to 5 centimeters up someone's bum, and then rotate it gently. Often you have to do this twice. And China has been sort of doing this, and sometimes in clinical studies, sort of comparing what happens when you anal swab test someone versus when you test them in the nose or throat, preferably with different Q-tips, to see. And in the right order, to see which test is more accurate and effective and so on. The background science is, by the way, that some of the most interesting developments that we talked about in April last year were in testing sewage, because that seemed to be a way that you could get around all of the difficulties in getting a genuine prevalence sample. If you just see... And what's important to understand is that the virus is made up of various proteins. Right. And so when it breaks down, those proteins still exist. So you can pick up trace proteins of the virus, even though it's not contagious or viable.
I remember this. They did a whole bunch of studies in cities across the world, and they looked at the sewage and they said, there's going to be a big increase in hospitalizations in like a week or two because we've just seen a big spike in the COVID content in the sewage. And lo and behold, it seems to pretty much be the case every time.
Yeah, it worked pretty well. There were also some disturbing things, like in Spain, they found traces from... So by the way, in a lot of countries, they take sewage samples and then just sort of keep them in cold storage for a while. So they could go backwards in time from before the outbreak and see when coronavirus proteins. And they were finding coronavirus proteins, I think the earliest was in April 2019 in Spain. And there it's not clear if it was a genuine coronavirus, if it was SARS-CoV-2 or if it was something similar that had an overlapping protein. Definitely they found higher traces towards the end of the year in ways that suggested that the outbreak had sort of predated the news of it to some extent.
I think that's definitely clear, but it's just not really clear whether there was anything in April of 2019.
Yes, no, the April one is... it's very... I actually reached out to those academics and got no response.
Yeah.
I think they were a bit embarrassed about their results.
Yeah, it's possible that they... It's always possible they could have made a mistake or something. So it's interesting to think about that at the very least, there may have been something vaguely similar floating about in people's immune systems prior to COVID.
The point is that this was important... both from a sociological point of view and from a contact tracing point of view, especially if you think about how many people are changing diapers and nurses that are dealing with small infants and stuff. Right. This is kind of funny because my oldest friend just had a baby today. But, you know, it is babies are messy little bundles of joy. And so there was a worry that if a 1 year old that's still using a nappy has the virus, their fecal matter might be a way of spreading the disease. And then you'd want to know that. You'd want to communicate that to the public. So there are tests being done on that, and they found that, like, once it's that far down the track, so to speak, it's way too late.
Contagious, yeah.
It's way too late for it to be contagious. So in this regard, the Chinese argument is just that asymptomatics might last longer. You might pick up after someone's no longer contagious. You can still pick up trace proteins in their mucus. But even after that, you might be able to pick up in the anal swabs. But so from a contact tracing point of view, it's useless because you're just more likely to get effectively false positives.
Right. But they
on the best available evidence, it's the worst kind of test to apply to teachers and tourists coming in. But Beijing has been applying it, and they did it to some U.S. diplomats. And there was a great fracas because the U.S. State Department last week, it was reported in the Washington Post, and then the State Department confirmed it, that their diplomats in Beijing had been subjected to anal swab tests. And the U.S. complained about this. They said this is degrading their humanity or something like that. And then the Chinese response was, no, we've never done that. And then it was, no, to the best of our knowledge, we've never done that. And then it was, no, we've never done that. But at the same time, we won't do it again. To diplomats, because they should be subject to a different set of rules. And then the Japanese were like, okay, whatever, that's your fight. You are doing it to our citizens, and we really would like you to exclude them from this. Mm. And China has not given a response, and so the Japan Times carried the story yesterday saying, we're very angry about this, and we're leveling up our petition.
Do we know how much China is doing it to its own citizens? The reason I bring this up is because Chinese television, media, propaganda, everything is suffused with anti-Japanese stuff, right? So there's still a very deep dislike for the Japanese in mainland China left over from the Second World War. We talked about, of course, the brutal Japanese invasion and occupation in the 30s and 40s. But the Chinese government very much keeps that alive. And so you can probably find clips of it on YouTube. But for example, there are clips from Chinese action movies where a Chinese hero is fighting the Japanese and defeating 50 Japanese soldiers by himself and that kind of thing, which makes one wonder why it took them so long to win the war if that was the case. But this is like it's very constant that there's a lot of anti-Japanese stuff there, and China often positions itself as being defensive against Japan, as containing Japanese aggression. And so the idea that they might, shall we say, be a little bit more eager to do this kind of test on Japanese citizens as opposed to Chinese citizens would not surprise me. So do we know if they're doing it to the Chinese?
I know from one report from Japan Times that over 1,000 Chinese teachers have been subjected to this test. There is an intimation that the way that things have been progressing, because this started at the beginning of the year, the way that things have been progressing is that it seems to have been more foreigners that are taking it, literally up the bum. I'm sorry, I don't know how to talk about this
in a delicate
without
manner.
Sounding silly, yes. but I do think that's part of the... Yeah, I mean, my reading is that Japan and China relate to each other a little bit in pop culture as England and France does. So accepting that the salient difference is that England was very happy to join. The UK was very happy to be part of the EU for a while and very eager to be part of NATO together. You know, geostrategically, they are in alliance, whereas Beijing and Tokyo are geostrategically somewhat at loggerheads.
Yeah, and they haven't, France and Britain haven't had a serious fight for like 200 years. Whereas China and Japan, it's not only more recent, but it's kept alive by the Chinese sort of official line on that war.
And there's this, and there are other problems. I mean, the early in the coronavirus, Japan was very critical of China's refusal to allow proper investigation into the circumstances under which SARS-CoV-2 emerged. They spoke out in favor of Dr. Ai Fen, who, by the way, is just as an aside, we're coming around to the anniversary of Dr. Ai Fen.
His death.
No. So Ai Fen is not discovery. The one who died. No, Ai Fen is a lady.
I remember.
She was the whistle giver. She basically was part of the team that isolated the virus and sort of spread the word that this is a problem. And Dr. Li was the one who contracted it and died.
Yes, you're correct.
But Dr. Ai Fen was chastised for raising the alarm. And then it was in early March 2020 that she gave a series of interviews, one in particular to The Guardian, I think it was, where she drew attention to the fact that she had been criticized for spreading the word, saying, I'm the whistle giver, Li was the whistleblower. It's all very tragic that he's died. And I'm very sorry that I didn't, you know, that when I was reprimanded, I just took the rap on the knuckles and stayed quiet. I really should have pushed harder, and I'm sorry about that. She subsequently went missing and then reemerged under semi-mysterious circumstances and then went for an operation on her eyes. She was starting to lose her vision. And something went wrong with the procedure. And she blames the hospitals, and there's this very weird thing where the hospital she was at had three ophthalmologists who all died, so she had to get some other doctor to do the procedure, and it didn't go right. So she's now nearly blind and weak and incapable of holding her children.
It's not unusual for people to go sort of missing for periods of time like this in China. I know that it happens time to time. There was a Chinese billionaire who recently criticized the state. And I think he was nasty about Xi Jinping in particular. And he suddenly disappeared from public view for a while. And I'm not sure if he reemerged, but it's not unusual for this kind of thing to happen.
No. But I do think that there's a
brutal place.
There's something about, you know, people, I think it's a very bad idea to resign important truths to those members of the ultra left who just use them in toxic ways all the time. But the thought of the body as being a location where politics expresses itself, that's a powerful and old idea. And, you know, those who fought against slavery in the UK, for example, in the early 1800s, the back of a black man that bears the marks of lashes. This was an important manifestation of a political system that they didn't like. And also people being in chains on their knees. This was a thing to push against. That kind of politics is important. And the politics of a country where, on the one hand, you sort of have doctors aimlessly probing foreigners and teachers.
Right.
And on the other hand, where the very best doctors are going blind. I think it's just a disturbing kind of coincidence
I think in
this moment in our history that speaks to a broader worry that I have that of this sort of super powerful state that's at once very probing and very blind to human rights.
Right.
And
I think all these scandals do give a good sort of texture of what the Chinese state is like. It's sort of, it's very almost machine-like. In a way, you know, that sort of that idea of ruthlessness, I think they really do, you know, that kind of ruthless efficiency that authoritarian regimes are often allegedly have but don't actually have in reality because they're completely dysfunctional. The Chinese state unfortunately does seem to have some ruthless efficiency,
does some of that. And for all, I mean, welding people into their apartments in Wuhan is such a case.
Right,
that's
exactly.
I'd love to go to Shanghai and see what's going on. But the bigger geo, you know, when we say that Japan and Tokyo and Beijing are at loggerheads, that obviously the really big issue over the last couple of years has been Hong Kong and its independence. Yes. Japan was one of the first and strongest critics of China's recalibration of the rules to undermine Hong Kong sovereignty. And
in fact, the Japanese are playing big games here. They have specifically decided that the next couple of years their economic focus is going to be attracting investment from China. So they've begun a campaign around the world to sort of convince people to disinvest from China and instead move to Japan, because their economy is, you know, it has its problems, but they're kind of arguing, you know, you can't trust China. China abuses human rights. China does all these evil things. You might as well come and invest here. It's also in the Far East. Everyone works hard. We might not have the same youthful, although fast aging, workforce as the Chinese. We may have more laws and stuff, but we're more stable.
And it's important as a part of that sort of broader, you know, when we talk about China, we almost always end up reflecting on the fact that almost none of its neighbors are closely aligned with Beijing. They're more cowed by it.
With the exception of the military junta in Myanmar.
Yes.
So that's the one.
But I think Japan's sort of under Abe, who has a kind of nationalist streak to him that I think makes people worry, when, especially when they think of the kind of Japanese nationalism that we talked about so much in that episode. But he does seem to be trying to put up a tent pole that smaller countries around China's orbit can sort of gather under as American power potentially retreats from the region. Japan, I think, looks to play a more sort of active guardian.
Reassertive role. Yeah. And it's got a lot of allies in the region, of course, too, because, you know, South Korea, even though they really don't like Japan, also from that period in the 30s, 40s, when they were, I mean, even before then, because Korea was occupied by Japan for a long time. You know, I think South Korea does recognize, of course, the threat of North Korea and China. And then you've also got other countries like Vietnam and the Philippines, which are, especially Vietnam, quite concerned about the rise of Chinese nationalism. Because, you know, if you look at Vietnam's history in particular, every time China's had a strong centralized state, they've invaded Vietnam.
And when you say every time, it's like that's a pattern that goes on for
like hundreds of years. Yeah.
Well, yeah, for longer than France has been a country.
Right. In fact, there's a great Vietnamese hero called Lê Lợi, who I think I wrote about in one of my This Week in History pieces. But he is famous for actually driving the Chinese out of Vietnam in the 1400s.
Yeah.
So this is their founding national myth.
Yeah. Back when the Sistine Chapel was still a glimmer in someone's eye, the Vietnamese and Chinese were already beefing.
Going at each other.
And while we're on this region and punting work, I just want to say Indonesia has where Nicholas has been and a country that his father has strong connections with. Indonesia has done something of global significance. Thousands of companies gathered up together to try and push for independent purchasing of vaccines for distribution to their staff and their families. And this is important in part because Indonesia is the fourth most populous country in the world, and in part because it's got a similar problem to South Africa, where it's so big that there are, you know, this is the problem we call inequality. It's so big that it's got a hell of a lot of poor people, but it's actually also got quite a lot of successful businesses.
Unlike here, its economy has been growing a lot faster, but carry on.
So the government can't really afford to vaccinate everyone, doesn't really have the capacity to vaccinate everyone, but there are companies that could accelerate the process by stepping in. They lobbied, the government said no, they lobbied some more, the government said no, and then finally the government said yes, and purchase deals were struck last week. And so millions and millions of vaccine jabs are now being purchased by private entities and to be distributed in Indonesia. And this matters. This is not the only example of anything like that. In Bangladesh, a private company really wanted to buy tens of millions of vaccines. Government couldn't afford it. The company said, look, here's what we'll do. We'll pay for half the vaccines, and then the government can have them, and then we'll help redistribute them. So if nominally it's going through the government, but really the private entity is doing a lot. That's another version. Mexico has had private lobbying. They forced the president of Mexico to say, okay, I accept private companies can buy this, although it doesn't look like it's actually gone through yet. In Brazil, Bolsonaro was very anti-vax. So the governor of Sao Paulo said, sort of struck a deal where a local vaccine producer in Sao Paulo would produce the vaccines, give them to Sao Paulo provincial government, state government, and then Sao Paulo's provincial government would give some to the federal government to redistribute around that. And that all matters from a South African perspective because Adrian Gore, the head of Discovery, has said that no vaccine producer will sell to anyone excepting for a national government. So that's already not been true since
all over the world.
January in Brazil. Indonesia's gone all the way with private companies buying it. SII, the Serum Institute of India, has agreed to sell their vaccines to private companies in India for 5 times the price they sell to governments. But all around the world, there are private companies. Also in South Africa, Lamar International, a Cape-based pharmaceutical, said that Sputnik V would...
which is the Russian vaccine.
Yeah, produced by, what is it called? Galica or something. That company said that they would sell them to Lamar and ship them on the next available flight as soon as SAPA approves it. So Gore's just talking nonsense. And it really matters because South Africa, I wrote a piece about this in News 24. You should feel free to go check it out. You'll sort of see the numbers.
It is behind the paywall though. So maybe it'll come out somewhere else the next couple of days, but for now, you'll need a subscription to watch it. I know I'm backtracking here a bit, but I do just want to talk about Indonesia a bit because it is kind of it's a country that gets ignored a lot, but it's really interesting.
Yeah.
So I think it's either second or most populous Muslim country in the world. And so actually a huge body of the Islamic world is all the way in Indonesia, and it sort of doesn't fall into the focus when people talk about the Islamic world often. So that's an interesting thing about it. But what I was saying about GDP growth, I just went and double checked it. And 2018, 5%, 5.2% growth. 2019, 5% growth. 2020, the year of the coronavirus pandemic, Indonesia is like the third country to get hit there. Virus response isn't great. 2% contraction, as opposed to our 7%. And the forecast for this year is 6.1% growth.
So compared to South Africa, real-time contraction in both 2018, 2019, nominal growth of 0.3% and 0.2% respectively.
Right. And also their unemployment in 2020, the year of the coronavirus pandemic and the lockdowns, soared to a sky high. Would you like to guess?
No.
8%.
Oh, my God.
I wish. Can you imagine South Africa at 8% unemployment? Much better.
You know what else is interesting about that? So South Africa stands out as having the highest minimum wage relative to the median wage I could find. But Indonesia is the closest. It's the only country that's where the minimum wage and the median wage are basically the same, meaning that sort of on the face of it, half – of all businesses and employees are illegal because they're working on the basis of contracts that don't line up with national legislation. But Indonesia had instituted this minimum wage many years ago, and they came up with a simple solution. So the problem is, once you've put a minimum wage in and it's too high, it's so high that it's going to drive up unemployment, you need to bring it down, but that's going to be politically unpopular because it's going to be like, how can you say that people should be living on, you know, less than $1 an hour or whatever for work?
Whatever it is.
So their solution was just not to enforce it.
Yes. to give you an idea also of how much of an achievement it is to get this many people employed. And also, I think their population below the poverty line as a percentage is lower than ours. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I think so. The island of Java, which is the most important island in Indonesia, right? It's smaller than the Eastern Cape, and it has 150 million people living on it.
Jeez, Larry.
It is, and it's also covered in volcanoes as well. So if they can do it, it's really hot all the time. Like, it's, you know, a cold day for Indonesians. Hot. When the temperature goes below 30 degrees, the Indonesians put on jerseys. Like that's for them. It's too cold. If they can do it, we really, really can do it.
Yeah.
And they are also a much more dysfunctional kind of, I mean, they have like separatist movements all over the place and radical Islamist terrorists and religious conflicts and it goes on and on and on. It's just the fact that they can get 5% economic growth, you know, for years and years when they've got war zones in multiple parts of the country.
Country, yeah, and a banking sector that's nowhere near like ours, anyway.
Right, exactly. So I want to go now to, considering we're on the East, we're talking about these dysfunctional countries. And I was having a thought the other day or yesterday in the shower where I have all of my good ideas. And this is about how do you judge a leader from a severely messed up country? So the example that first comes to mind, I'm sure some of our listeners are probably familiar with Mohammed bin Salman. He's the prince regent, so he's the heir to the throne and the real power in Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, you know, huge oil producer, very rich, important dude. He's a little bit unusual because he wasn't necessarily the next to be in line, but he was very ambitious. He's quite a young guy. I think he's like 32 or something like that.
I think he's a bit older, late 30s.
Yeah, his father, I think, is the current king, although his father is apparently like either senile or just very old and not able to kind of go with it, and that's why he's the real ruler. But he suddenly got placed into the line of succession through his own political maneuvering, and the Saudi royal family, it's a very cutthroat place, you know, all the different branches of the family always fighting over who's going to be the heir. He then appears to have arrested all of his relatives, and you know, because the Saudi royal family is so big, that was a lot of people who weren't part of his faction, basically. And he put them under house arrest in a luxury hotel, where I think they still are. Some of them tried to flee the country, and the armed forces under his command shot them down, and they died. So he's a pretty ruthless guy. He also famously dismembered the Washington Post columnist and opinion writer Jamal Khashoggi, who was a reporter from Saudi Arabia, and I think he was of an Islamist bent,
Yeah,
but
well,
I
he
don't
was
know that
based
much about the
somewhere
writing.
else, but he was visiting Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, he was visiting Turkey at the time to get a visa from the Saudi Arabian embassy to sort out his marriage or something like that. Anyway, he got, you know, brutally murdered and dismembered. Mohammed bin Salman, you know, obviously he's not elected; he's an absolute monarch. In fact, he's far more of a dictator than previous kings of Saudi Arabia because he rules without the rest of the family's consent, which is a traditional way of doing it. He's far more authoritarian, a brutal guy, a murderous guy, a thug. But he's made some moves to liberate women in Saudi Arabia. It was under him that women were allowed to drive. He made moves to open up the economy and diversify it. He's made moves to build alliances against Iran and make fix ties with Israel and do all sorts of things that I think we would probably argue are pretty good things. So the question is, how should we judge him? And you can think of other leaders like this, the leader of Ethiopia, right, who instituted this crackdown on the Tigrayan people, which was pretty brutal.
Abiy
But
Ahmed,
he's
yeah.
also private. Yeah, but he's also privatized the economy and made peace with Eritrea. And you can come up with numerous other examples of this.
Paul
Should we
Kagame.
judge them? Well, Paul Kagame, another good one, right? He murders political opponents all the time in horrific ways, usually in Sandton hotels. And yet, he's improved Rwanda's economy a lot and stopped the civil war there. So here's my question, right? This is a sort of genuine moral problem. How do we judge these leaders from these countries? Do we look at them and say, this person is cruel, this person is evil, they're brutal, they didn't have to become the leader of this country, but they chose to be, they chose to invest themselves in this evil, corrupt system that their country's part of, and therefore they're a morally reprehensible person. Even if they do some good things, it doesn't make up for the evil they do. Or should we judge them very contextually and say, look, these people, these leaders are trying to do the best in severely messed up countries? I mean, Saudi Arabia has, as far as I'm concerned, a pretty broken sort of esteem economy and moral compass baseline. Like it's just a nasty place generally for politics and freedom. And if you consider that context, should we then say, okay, compared to how bad they could be, they're not so bad. What's your thoughts on this? You're a philosophically minded chap.
Okay, so
I think it's a difficult question.
I think it is really difficult. I think two thinking tools that are helpful are as follows. The first is the notion of group agency. So there are, you know, I believe that a kind of collective responsibility is appropriate when a kind of collective action is what's being discharged. Right. When, you know, when one country goes to war with another country, it really is fair to say that the country's gone to war with another country. Criminal justice system, the rule of law, they all depend on collaborative action, both in reporting crimes and helping the police and paying your taxes and so on. We kind of, if you don't believe in any collective action, nice philosopher's example is, do you think it's possible for a group of people to surround a building? Conceptually, no one person can surround a building. It can only be done by a group. So it does seem like there are collective actions, and where there are collective actions, there should be collective responses. Now, the tricky thing about group agency is that it does incline one to make the kinds of claims that you've made, which might actually be contradicted by fact. The key concept to try and track is control. So did Vladimir Putin poison Alexei Navalny? Did Mohammed bin Salman slaughter Khashoggi? Paul Kagame the guy who killed the Rwandese dissident in Santon? And the question there really is, were they in control? It's not necessarily whether they ordered it, but in a sense, were they in control? And what's complicated about that in a dictatorship or something approaching a dictatorship, because of course Rwanda is not one, and neither is Ethiopia, is you can be in control of something if you, as it were, allow it to happen, if it suits your interests and you allow it to happen. And the classic sort of English example is some king who said, you know, that archbishop is really getting on my nerves. It'd be wonderful if he disappeared.
What is his name? Archbishop in the 1200s. I can't remember his name. Will no one rid me of this turbulent priest, he said aloud while some of his knights were in the room. And they then went and stabbed the priest to death on the steps of the altar.
Yes, and then no one gets punished. So if you kind of signal that you really want this to happen and then it happens and you don't punish anyone and you do have the ability to punish, then I think it's fair to say you were in control. But there's two kinds of questions. The one question is, did they order it? And it's not clear to me that Khashoggi is... murder was ordered by MBS. It's not clear to me at all that Navalny's poisoning was ordered by Putin, or that the assassination in Santon was ordered by Paul Kagame. It's also not clear to me that those respective leaders were or are in a position to genuinely punish the guilty parties. That's part of what's slippery about it, is that with more facts, I'd know really better how to make a judgment. In the absence of those facts, it's very tempting to, if one is sympathetic, say, look, it's a terrible country. There are people out there who are trying to get ahead, and they think this is a way to get ahead. And it's very hard to punish them because they're so surrounded by corrupt law enforcement systems that finding a judicial system, you know, finding a judge and a prosecuting authority and a police who are going to work together to put forward a fair and credible trial that's going to convict is unlikely to happen. And if it does or it doesn't turn on what the leaders want. It turns on problems that are outside of their control. That's the sympathetic line. And the antagonistic line is, look, all roads in Russia lead to Putin. All roads in Ethiopia lead to Little Addis.
Yeah. And he's ultimately that's part responsible of as a leader. Okay, but let's assume, for the sake of this particular discussion, that these reprehensible actions were indeed very deliberate, either encouraged by or directly ordered by the leaders in charge. So I think I see the CIA, I think it is, has just come out with a report on Khashoggi's killing, and they basically said, look, the guy who actually gave the order to do the killing. Has said previously that he would never make take any action without Mohammed bin Salman's express permission, and also Mohammed bin Salman wouldn't need to give him like a sort of public statement or anything. He could have just literally picked up the phone to him or just said something in a private conversation. Take out this guy, he's causing a problem. So let's assume that he did that they did do these terrible things.
Good.
How then do we tackle this problem?
The second conceptual tool. So the first is just trying to think carefully about control. The second conceptual tool. Just to clarify, the first is trying to link up control with responsibility. But then the second one is trying to link up responsibility with a broader moral framework. And here the challenge is, and it's a very serious challenge for classical liberals, I suppose for anyone, is thinking about how the rules of the game really ought to change when the circumstances change. And there's a paradigm exemplar, which is the just war. Just in case you're in a just war, I think most people agree you have to operate according to a different moral standard. And the obvious thing is that outside of a just war, you just can't go killing people that are strangers and that are unarmed. And some people try to use that standard and say, well, in war, what really justifies soldiers shooting at each other is self-defense. It's like, if I don't kill you, you'll kill me. But that's nonsense. If you read Catch-22, the great American satire on World War II by Joseph Heller, Yossarian and the main character sort of keeps making this argument, guys, you don't have to go kill them in self-defense. You can just run away. That is, you've got a much better chance of surviving, especially because they were in the Air Force and there was very high attrition rates of American Air Force in Europe. You just have a much better chance.
They didn't win World War II by just sitting back and waiting for the Germans to exhaust themselves in their defensive positions.
Yeah. And that book starts out with him in a hospital saying, you know, I think I'm too mentally screwed up to fly. And the doctors say, well, if you're mentally screwed up, then you can't fly. But the fact that you're saying this shows that you're not mentally screwed up, because only an insane person would fly, given the chances you have of dying. And then he says, well, so hold on. So you're saying I mustn't fly. You're saying I must fly because I'm sane enough to know that I shouldn't fly. And they say, yes, that's catch 22. It's in the army code. That's where the phrase comes from. If you're crazy, then they'll make you fly because you can. And if you're not crazy and you say I shouldn't fly, then there's no way out. That's evidence that you're clearly sane enough to fly. So, the point is that, and the other way of putting it is that if you think of certain conventional kinds of warfare, it really is just soldiers lining up to shoot each other across trenches where everyone's armed. But if you look at real, how wars really play out, you often are, you know, sitting in a position where you can kill an enemy soldier that's not armed but is behind enemy lines, not in a position where you can take him in as a prisoner of war. And there's no commanding officer or general who's going to say you shouldn't shoot them. It's just not a viable practice. So one rule that changes is killing unarmed strangers. That goes from being a definite no-no. I mean, that is as certain a no-no as there can be, to being something that's not just allowed, but that it'll be your duty to do. And it can be hard for people to do that. I think morally sensitive people struggle with that.
Yeah, it's psychologically traumatizing.
And the same thing with freedom of speech. Most people know this line about freedom of speech, which is that if you're in a crowded theater and you shout fire, then everyone is going to storm to get out of the thing, and that could actually result in people stamping each other to death. And so you shouldn't shout fire in a theater. Now, that example assuming there's no fire, you shouldn't shout fire. Now, that sort of example came out of a Supreme Court of the United States judgment, I think in World War I, when Woodrow Wilson's administration.
yes, under the evil of the Wilson administration, worst president of the 20th century. But sorry, carry on.
and former president of my alma mater. Yes, indeed. Woodrow, that administration said, look, we can't have people spreading fake news and agitating against the war and, compromising our ability
the country,
to go to war. And that was the real case. The fire case, that shouting fire in a theater thing, that's just a sort of meme that's proved very sticky. The real idea was that you must be allowed to curtail freedom of speech in war, because it's a really bad idea not to do that. And if you look, Nicholas and I have been talking about sieges. If you look at the history of warfare in Europe for the last 500 years, a lot of it's about sieges. And if someone spreads fake news in a siege, it really can have devastating consequences. Mm. And so curtailing free speech is something that we've, you know, it's a strong principle. You must allow free speech. But in times of a just war,
Set of rules applies. This concept of the different rule set, does it apply to these tyrannical societies?
Yeah, so that's the background idea, is that they're so far from being well-constituted liberal societies that there is something like a low-level war going on. South Africa was much like that, by the way, during apartheid. You know, it had a constitution, it had the vote, but that was restricted on the basis of race. And so the ANC's, you know, Mandela's argument at the Rivonia trial was that there are four tiers to his just war theory. And his thought was things aren't bad enough to justify outright warfare where you can just go kill unarmed police or members of state. Things aren't so bad that you can even just go out and kill armed forces. But things are so bad that you can go out and destroy infrastructure. And in that sense, he pled guilty to treason because he said, I don't respect the sovereignty of this country. I think we are in something like a just war scenario. And this is part of what's so difficult about just war theory, is that it not only says you've got something approaching a well-constituted liberal state in which the rules of the game are thus and so, freedom loving, you know, you've got to use free means to achieve free ends. But that when you skip out of that into a just war situation, that's not just like suddenly anything goes, that there are still gradations, more and less are allowed.
Stages within the just war.
And so in that sense, you could say that, you know, the Kagame provides an example that I was confronted with when I landed in Rwanda in 2006, visiting my sister as a teenager. Just before I got onto the flight, I was chatting with my sister, and she said that someone on the radio, I was flying there for Genocide Memorial Week, as it turns out. We hadn't planned it that way. But I'd been chatting with her about this and that logistics, and then she said, oh, just by the way, I was listening on the radio, and some guy said that the cockroaches must be exterminated. That was the night before I flew. By the time I'd landed the next day and made it home, we listened on the radio to a report that person had been found and killed. And there was no doubt in anyone's mind that he'd been found and killed by – I mean, it was explicit. This was by Rwandese secret police, and no one had any doubt that Paul Kagame was on board with that. And – In a free society, that would be absolutely unacceptable. There's no habeas corpus. There's no procedure.
There's no trial, no law, nothing. It's just straight up death.
Yeah. But when you consider the circumstances on the ground, it was very hard to find a Rwandese, Hutu or Tutsi, that didn't think that was a good thing, because they're so traumatized by the genocide that had happened at that stage only 12 years earlier. That they considered themselves to be in the aftermath. They saw this as an exercise in the aftermath of a just war, an extrajudicial process that sort of justified in the same way that it was justified for Kagame to march in with a Tutsi-led army to take out the Hutu genocide perpetrators. So, I mean, I think that probably is a good example of something that really makes my skin crawl, but at the same time, I think any moral judgment about that particular action should be made within this broader context. And within this broader context, I start seeing reasonable arguments for tolerating it. It's harder. That's a harder case in the sense that than the Khashoggi case, because in the Khashoggi case, I just can't see a good argument for why Khashoggi
Right, that dude was running, you know. Look, it's possible that, obviously, this is always the defense made of these times. Oh, Khashoggi was meeting with Islamist radicals and they were going to overthrow the regime. And we had the secret information. We can't tell you about it because it's all, you know, from spies and informants. But, you know, that's just trust us. That's really why we wiped him out. Here's my problem, though, with this line of argument, because I don't have as developed a philosophical brain as you perhaps, Gabriel. So I tend to kind of have flagpoles that I regard as this is really bad. And if I come up with an argument that says that can justify that thing that I think is completely bad, then that argument can't be right. And I think about the way that people
this
talk
is,
about
Joseph this,
Stalin.
By the way, just to give you the philosophical name for this, this is the particularist approach. You have particular judgments. And that's the rock. And then you try and extrapolate
which
a theory
you build
from that.
From that, yeah. Okay.
Rather
I didn't
than
know
having
the name.
A theory
thank you.
First. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you for letting me know the name. So I'm an inadvertent particularist, apparently. Anyway, so I think of Stalin and the exact arguments that were made to justify his atrocious crimes against the people of the Soviet Union. They'll say, look, he industrialized the country. Look, he held it together after this vicious civil war. Look, he defeated the Nazis. Look, he modernized Russia. He lifted people up into literacy and all these things like that. And then you start to get into a game of almost like counting people against each other. So you say, okay, how many people given factory jobs is equal to one person being killed?
Yeah.
And then your whole moral equation is this like horrible numerical wishy-washy thing.
Yeah, you get to the point where it's how many Jews can you gas to justify one Volkswagen?
Right. And that to me just seems insane. You know, you can't go
Correct.
Down that road.
That is
so true. So how do we stop from sliding into that particular pitfall if you do judge people in their sort of context of a bad society? You know, if you're the leader of an awful place.
Yeah, I think that I think one important thing to do is hold on to that intuition, and the broadest sort of theoretical point that you can extrapolate from it is something like the necessity of a deontic moral, that somewhere along the line. You can't just think the means justify the ends. Somewhere along the line, you've got to include the thought that this thing is just not acceptable.
I've always thought that the sort of deontological versus consequentialist thing is a bit funny because it almost seems like both should be taken into consideration rather than just one.
That's exactly right. And so the way I think of it is that there should be a sort of what philosophers call the reflexive equilibrium. So you try and figure out how screwed up or how well constituted is the society, and then that'll give you a guideline. That'll allow you to create a stable framework and say, within this society, these are the means that are off limits. And in no society is it ever acceptable to sort of build cars or factory jobs out of the bones of innocent human beings.
Yeah.
So that's never on. And then sort of you scale it up to, you know, in this society, okay, you're not building cars out of this, but you are trying to overthrow a totalitarian regime. You're trying to destroy the Nazis.
Right.
So bombing Danzig can be justified. In this society, it's not as bad as the Nazis. So bombing Joburg, not justified, but bombing some unoccupied building is justified.
Right.
So you look at the consequences and the context to try and find a particular set of rules for a particular level of disorder, and I think on that basis it just does look like you could make pretty hard judgments. Like there is no justification for what happened to Khashoggi, there is no justification for what happened to Navalny, there is no justification for what happened to the Rwandese man who was assassinated in Santon. There just wasn't nearly enough of a credible threat. Of mass murder being averted by killing these individuals for anything like that to be justified. I think that's important. The flip side is, you know, what's interesting about Nicholas is that he is in the American context a conservative, And conservatives have been making a lot of political hay out of MBS, because Mohammed Bil Salman, because of course Donald Trump's position was, no, Mohammed Bil Salman was not involved with this, and we'll keep doing deals with the Saudis because their leader's innocent and it was some other problem and let's look away from it. Whereas Biden's position was, no, MBS did this, he's a really bad guy, but now that he's in charge, it's very hard for him
to withdraw. We have to deal with him, yeah.
And the CIA is now coming out with harder evidence that he does seem to be involved. So it's like, Biden's a hypocrite. So this allegation of hypocrisy, I mean, you haven't been trying to accuse the Democratic Party of that. But I just want to say, even if your moral judgments are one thing, and again, control is very important, because how you actually act out of them is going to depend on what your relationship is.
That was exactly the point I was going to make, is on one hand, there's a moral judgment. And then what follows from that is, what should we actually do? Yeah. Because simply knowing that something is bad doesn't mean that we immediately need to intervene if that's not actually going to make things better. And so I think that also should form part of the moral equation here is, and I think about Egypt here as a good example, right? So Egypt, they had a revolution, they threw out their military dictator. And there was a kind of really shambolic, not very well-organized election where lots of people didn't vote. And they voted in a president who was from the group known as the Muslim Brotherhood, who are Islamists. And he was, according to the rules, technically democratically elected. But what did he do as soon as he was in power? He began cracking down on the religious minority. So Egyptian Christians began to get targeted by mobs and things. He began to strip away freedom of speech and freedom of religion from the constitution. He began to align Egypt militarily with the sort of, expansionist Turkey and all these like very aggressive militaristic powers in the Middle East. He was breaking agreements with Israel. It was heading for something that looked bad. And he got overthrown by a sort of half popular, half uprising, half coup that put another military dictator in power.
Yeah.
So when thinking about this, it's difficult for me to not sympathize with the coup, which is never a position one wants to be in. Egypt has continued to be an autocratic, fairly badly run place since the new military dictatorship came in. But at least it's not sort of, chopping up Coptic Christians in their churches anymore.
Yeah.
And so if I was, let's say, the American president, and I was deciding whether to stop the coup or not, from, use the CIA to try and block the coup.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't have.
Yeah. Yeah. And how weird does that feel? But I think it doesn't feel good. but so here I think is a dastardly but important thought. Hypocrisy is an essential and sometimes positive element of the human condition.
What's the phrase? Hypocrisy is the tribute vice pays to virtue.
Yes, very good, Nick. And so sometimes.
Someone clearly said that.
Sometimes saying, look, morally, I'm really not on board with what this guy's doing, but pragmatically, I'm not going to try and intervene. In fact, I'll even continue collaborating, tacitly or explicitly, because I just don't have the power to intervene in such a way that's going to do more good than harm. That's just an unfortunate position that people sometimes find themselves in, because power is ultimately dictated by violence, and your ability to do violence in narrow focused ways that really targets bad actors and that avoids collateral damage is extremely limited just by the fact that those bad actors have violence on their side too, and so can put use innocent people effectively as body shields. So I mean, that's pretty gloomy, but what's the nice side of it? The nice side of it is that when you live in a well-constituted democracy like South Africa, I look at this and I think, what a wonderful position we're in, where you don't have to be hypocritical. Like the means for removing bad actors from power,
right,
is not, you don't have to make this moral choice of like, is it worth killing someone or not? Is it worth, going around judicial processes, repressing free speech?
Right.
No, you can just, we are in the position
where you can go and vote, we can go and protest.
You can use good means to achieve good ends. And that was, and that didn't come for free. That came on the, from the blood that other people were willing to sacrifice of their own.
And this is perhaps, I think, what reveals one of the worst crimes of tyranny, is that tyranny so destroys our ability to sort of maneuver, and it so constricts everything, and it so poisons everything, that there become no options left except bad ones. There's just, the choice then is always between less bad and more bad. And that's destroying to the soul.
Yeah.
And that's why we should guard liberty closely, because it's the only thing that allows you to have a good choice.
Exactly. And why it's so frustrating when people who are in a well-constituted liberal society don't exercise that very limited power, the very limited powers that you have to use your voice, to use your vote, to change the background conditions for everyone's choices, are so easy to, it's these kinds of real historical cases and thought experiments where it's all so complicated, they should be the spur to our moral energy to say, you know, thank goodness we're not actually sitting in that position where you have to be a hypocrite, or you have to be a murderous person, or you have to just sit back and allow someone else to be a murderous person. No, you can use good means to do good ends. I'm very grateful to live such a life. And I think, you know, if I can say one last thing about that, when you say there's no good choices, there's an interesting passage in Seneca, who was one of the great sort of Roman era philosophers and playwrights. And he was talking about slavery. And he had he has this beautiful passage where he says, slavery is terrible because it gives you no good choices. Because if you're a slave, the only way to get out of it is to break the rule of laws, to break the property rights system that's holding the economy together. But if you don't break that and you just go along with it, then you're breaking freedom, your own freedom.
Yeah, you're destroying liberty. You're dehumanizing yourself.
Exactly. So it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. But he said the only solace that I can offer that I can think of that's provided by the world is that your mind is still sitting in your brain between your ears, and you can use it at your own discretion privately, and you can enjoy, you know, basically you can enjoy the sunset. And those natural goods that we get out of beauty, out of the beauty of the world, out of the beauty of free internal thought and private relations, are, he said, this is a very poor solace, but it is some solace. And it's just important to remember, you can never take all the good stuff away from anyone.
Right.
And
something is always better than nothing.
Yeah. And there's beautiful movies about the Holocaust where people are still trying to sort of get married in Auschwitz and stuff like that, which kind of speaks to the same idea. But there's an interesting moment where Bernard Williams, who's one of the great British philosophers, he describes this as one of the most morally pugnacious things he's ever come across. I think out of a kind of woke impulse to damn anything that makes slavery not seem that bad. And I wouldn't want, and that's the wrong idea. It's not saying it's not that bad. And when we say like these moral dilemmas are impossible and there's no good choice, but there's still some humanity there, it's not to say that it's not that bad. It's to say, look at how bad it is. It's so bad that the only thing you have left that's good
is this,
is breakfast and a sunset.
Yeah.
And that's not a way to live it.
Very good. No, I think that's a good note to end on. I just want to say that apparently the quote, hypocrisy is a tribute that vice pays to virtue, is a quote from Francis Duc de la Rochefoucauld. In his book Reflections or Sentences and Moral Maxims. So I'm not familiar with this character, but I have heard the quote before.
He's very witty and very cynical. Jesus.
He sounds like a good proper French writer.
He's one of those guys who's got a line along the lines of, like, you know, someone came over to my house because they wanted to do me a favor, and I immediately ran away.
So, with that in mind, what are we closing off today? What are our recommendations? Do you have anything on your mind?
Nick, please go first.
This always happens. Okay. I will go with a bit of a lazy recommendation, because I'm sure many of our listeners have probably come across this before. But it is, of course, the BBC program QI, which is a lot of fun. They examine lots of weird little facts and theories about the world, and they try to make you think. They try to bust myths about commonly held ideas. Was hosted by Stephen Fry. Now it's hosted by, what's her name? Sandy Tostvig, I think is her name. Anyway, you can find lots of clips of its best stuff on YouTube for free. So you don't have to even trawl through BBC episodes or anything like that. Just go look up QI. Tons of fun stuff to watch there if you haven't watched it already. And if you have watched it again, because it's good stuff.
Very good. I like that. My recommendation would be, off the back of this episode, the novel by Jame Coetzee Elizabeth Costello, which I think was the second that he wrote after he won the Nobel Prize. And it's about this fictional professor who convinces herself of a moral argument that killing animals is like murdering humans, and that battery farming them is sort of a sin worse than the Holocaust. And he actually started this out by delivering a Tanner lecture at Princeton University, sort of in this persona, which got a lot of people very angry. And then he sort of uses this, writes this in, the sort of angry rabbi is saying, how can you compare this to the Holocaust and so on. But one of the sort of stark points in the book is that Costello comes to this position where she feels so alienated by her moral compass. It's so far apart from everyone else's that she feels she can't live a good life because she's too far outside of her times, because she's not living in the context of the moral universe that she occupies. She's sort of become an angel in another realm.
In a world of devils, yeah.
Yeah, and that ends up, she finds a beautiful argument for that being immoral too, for it being immoral to be too much of a moral saint. It's very perverse. It's very Coetzee. It's very challenging, but it's a great read. It's really scintillating stuff.
Cool. All right, I think that's all we've got for today. So thank you very much for listening, everyone. We hope you enjoyed it, and we will see you soon. Keep the flag of liberty flying. Grr, 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 grr.